Welcome to Hot D, the officially unofficial podcast for House of the Dragon on HBO. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking Season 1, Episode 3, Second of His Name. Aaron, how'd you feel after the second of your watches?
I liked it. The only thing that still kind of bugs me on multiple watches is I do think the action scene at the end is a little bit goofy. And some of the stuff, I just didn't understand the tactics and strategy in the Stepstones whole department. But like, you got to understand that they were really, they had a pretty broad and blank canvas to paint the Stepstones war on. In the book, this is a one paragraph, another one in one paragraph deals. In the books, it literally yada yada, as it says, "It's not our purpose here to recount the details of the private war Daemon Targaryen and Corlys Velaryon waged on the Stepstones. Suffice it to say, the fighting began in 106 AC. Prince Daemon had little difficulty assembling an army of landless adventurers and second sons and won many victories during the first 2 years of the conflict. Yet in 108 AC, when at last he came face to face with Kragas Crabfeeder, he slew him single-handed and cut off his head with Dark Sister. Period. End of story."
Kragas. Does he call him Drehar in the episode?
That's his first name.
Okay. Gotcha.
Or maybe it's last name. Whichever one. Yeah, he's got it's one. Yeah. So, like, they had a lot of room to kind of, like, play around with this. And, like I mentioned in... I looked this up to make sure I wasn't crazy. It's in the canon to Sir Barristan Selmy, Barristan the Bold, when he was, like, 23 years old, single-handedly assaulted a castle. It was under cover of night and used a disguise to breach it. But he went in and rescued King Aerys from their dungeons and fought his way in and out. Broke into the fucking barn, stole horses, and rode out on horseback. Like, sometimes shit like this can happen, and I think you're supposed to understand that this was Daemon wagering at all. Like, he would literally, explicitly in the episode, rather die than ask his brother for help and suffer the fate of a second son. So, like, I guess I was okay with it. For me, I wish he was wearing plate armor and a helmet, and maybe had a shield but like, he is one of the best swordsmen of his time. He does have a excellent blade, Valyrian steel blade, Dark Sister, a very fabled blade. So I and again, I'm a little open to Arnold Schwarzenegger commando type of shenanigans. But everything else, all the Downton Abbey of it, the feasting and the fetting and the hunting, that shit is awesome, and I thought it's great. I really appreciated some of the stuff they're doing with symbolism and character and theme. What about you? How did the episode seem after another set of watches with your eyes?
I thought it was better on second watch. I felt like I understood more what they were going for. All the intricacies of, you know, this party, birthday party, name day party. Which, you know, combination royal hunt. I don't know exactly how that all goes, but I felt like I understood the tension here between duty and desire and everything that they're going for. And I think it's a lot better second time around. I will confess that I actually fast forwarded through the battle at the end because it was getting late when I was watching it second time through, and I'm like, this is all just action. Like, none of this actually matters. The stuff that I'm interested to talk about is not going to be in this part. So I fast forwarded through most of it, got to the metal as fuck shot at the end with Daemon walking out of the cave, dragging a half crab feeder. And I was like, yeah, that's all I really wanted out of this battle. I don't feel like it's a episode killer. I think everything else around it is great, but yeah, I was less interested in watching that again.
And if you are, you know, kind of like into that stuff, like, I think they did a lot in terms of choreography to share this like, you know, relentless momentum that he had. Like, he kind of started things off with this kind of somersaulting tackle down a sand dune, and then he hit the ground and he's just sprinting. And I guess that's where you don't wear armor and you don't have a shield to encumber you. I thought that there is a variety of ways that he was running and killing. It reminded me a little bit of Daniel Day-Lewis and some of the final moments of Last of Mohicans, where he's just like, you cannot fucking stop this man. He is on a mission. So I appreciated that. And I think also the dragon effects, again, some of the close-up stuff work. I kind of think that Lainor's a little funny looking. There's something about that, like that scoop hair with the silver hair that kind of makes him look a little like, like a prematurely gray Ronald McDonald type of thing.
Okay. Sure.
So, because I was looking, it's like, why isn't this? And I'm like, well, I just don't think he looks cool on this dragon.
I don't think anybody looks cool on a dragon, actually. I think they have a really hard time with the visuals when you do a close-up in the sky. A real hard time.
Right. That might, because like at best, you're going to see a person that looks like they're riding a horse, except for they're like, you know, their face is glowing from fire, you know, and that's but it's always like, you know, like if you if you try to fake a person riding a horse with green screen and whatnot, it would look kind of lame. Most of the time, you're actually watching a real ass person galloping, you know, hell for leather on a beast going 30, 40 miles. That's inherently exciting. I don't know. Maybe you're right. There's something that just doesn't translate. I hope that's not true, because there's a lot of exciting dragon stuff. And I think when you're seeing this from a remove, like the dragons is dive bombing and shooting fire. I know people shit talk to fire that they were breathing. Cyrax is breathing to incinerate Aemon and Balin Targaryen. But man, the fire effects they did in this episode were cool and percussive. And we had a medieval blown to safety with Daemon getting blown by sea smoke to safety. I thought that stuff looked really cool. The carnage, like I was watching the making behind the scenes, and they had this sweet idea where they made some of the axe heads and maces oversized and out of like this brittle wax and filled it with fake blood. So when you got guys, clanking a person across the face with a mace, it just looks like their face is exploding. And then out of frame, they've got production assistants with cupfuls of sand and cupfuls of blood just like laying on the ground. And when the guys clash, they just throw those cups in the air. So it looks like just gouts of blood and like spurts of You know, this is a pretty, again, this is a paragraph in the overall narrative of Fire and Blood. And they really went for broke on it. So I think this, to the extent there's going to be a lot of combat in this civil war between in House Targaryen, you can't help but be excited. You know, it's like, the tactics and strategy, but boy, if they can tell an exciting battle.
Absolutely. I mean, everything looks great except for the close-ups. I do wish they would just do these dragon fights, like you said, from a remove, because when they show the dragons from a distance, they look incredible. It's really only in those close-ups where they're trying to get the reactions of humans riding dragons or, you know, Targaryens, whatever they are. That's when it breaks down for me, but everything else looks awesome. The visuals is not what I have a problem with in this battle. It's more the pacing of it, and just like, does all of this make sense? And the answer is probably no, but ultimately who cares? It's about the outcome. And it's about, you're telling it's the story about why about he's doing it.
Daemon's desperation to, you know, get a type of social currency that he can spend to get into power. You know, that's what he's, it's about getting his brother's attention. It's about being,
it's about pride,
you know, about the inferiority complex, I think, that necessarily comes when you're a second son or worse in this society. I think it's another really solid episode that, you know, battles aside, delivered a lot of just great character moments, and just a way I feel like you are going to think back in episodes to come and seasons to come at conversations this episode and go, ooh, wish that person had been a little bit more diplomatic there. Oh, I wish that person had taken this person a little bit more seriously, because you are seeing, you know, the fault lines are going to eventually tear this realm in twain. So I think they're doing, like, as a person who's redhead, I think they're doing a great job at setting all this stuff up. And I'm so glad they're taking their time. So glad that we, like, I was worried that we were going to transition into the older period. No, not yet. Doesn't look like we're going to do it maybe even next episode either. I'm so glad they're taking time to really dwell on how things were before the true crisis point, so that it's going to make so much more sense. And people are going to have, like, rooting interests, you know?
Oh, yeah. No, I really appreciate the scenes where we get some insight into character motivations, like that scene with Viserys by the fire confessing to Alicent or telling Alicent about the dream he's had and how he was always a dreamer and he lost that somewhere along the way and feels like that could have been a mistake. I think that's a great scene. I think the scenes with Rhaenyra and him are excellent. The scenes with Rhaenyra and Kristen are excellent. All that stuff. Man, I just really appreciate the characterization they're doing here, battle scenes aside.
Mm-hmm. Here's what's new in premium content for our club members.
Executive producers get to exercise their voting fingers again this week with another prestige movie poll. This week's nominees are Mystic River, The Last Samurai, and Secondhand Lions. Take your pick and seal our fate.
This Monday on the Premium feed, we open up the books and deliver a State of the Empire podcast, talking about the current condition of Bald Move and our plans for this year.
This Friday, it's Lunch 420, which given last weekend seems like a tragic missed opportunity. Ah well, lunch will be served piping hot at 1 p.m. Eastern. Come join live or warm up some leftovers when lunch is released in podcast form later that day.
If you want more Bald Move in your life, head over to support.baldmove.com to find out how you can get tons of bonus audio and video content, plus ad-free feeds.
Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping.
All right, why don't we start with the recap?
Yeah.
The first scene here is the crab feeder feeding a man to the crabs, like you do, as they loot the ships they've destroyed. Then Daemon rides in on his dragon, drives crab feeder into hiding in the caves, but takes an arrow to the shoulder and flees. When is the scene actually taking place? Is this 3 years before everything else in the episode, or is this closer to the second name day of Aegon?
I think this is, like, if you read that paragraph I mentioned, that there's a 2 year period where he's having a lot of rapid successes and it looks like he's winning. And then it kind of bogs that. I feel like you're supposed to understand this is where the crab eater has been pushed back and there's enough stronghold on this Bloodstone Island that they can hide in the caves and be protected. This is a strategy that Dorne has been using for 100 years to successfully evade the Targaryens. Like, sure. Targaryens try to fuck up their shit. They come out of the mountains and, you know, gut a bunch of them. They bring the dragons. They melt back into the mountains. See also Afghanistan versus every major world power in the 20th century and 21st century. Like, it's a winning strategy, putting a whole bunch of hard rock and bones of the earth between you and the enemy.
Yeah.
I think it doesn't make as much sense in them continuing to be a threat and projecting power like they are, but yeah. And it's just I thought this is just amazing. This you start off seeing the striking Valyrian, you know, house sigil, the seahorse on fire, and this galley, some kind of either merchant or war galley, just burning down to the waterline. It's it looked like hell, and that was before the dragon showed up. That was just a crab feeder's business.
Yeah, it's a very cool looking scene. I noticed that this episode is bookended by Damon fucking the crab feeder shit up. and getting shot with an arrow in roughly the same place. I don't know what they're trying to do with that, but I don't know. I noticed the similarities.
In addition to being resistant to heat, the Targaryen armpit is just bulletproof. It's essentially a level 4 body armor.
But it's also a bullet magnet. So I guess that's convenient.
Right. Yeah. I thought it was, there's a lot of really cool moments, like the dragon Caraxes, which clearly does not give two fucks about these arrows, like using its shield or its giant wing as a shield for its master. I thought that was really cool.
Yeah.
And it just being kind of like pissed that these guys are fighting back. I thought that was a nice little character moment. Mm-hmm. The fire of Caraxes. Did you see the way it like incinerates the top halves of the guys? Like there's a gout of flame and there's dudes are running and it's just like their legs fall down and there's nothing left at the top half of them.
Jeez. Yeah, that dragon fire is hot.
It is super hot. But yeah, I don't know. I thought, like, to the extent that this show hasn't a lot of humor, I enjoyed the black humor of the Valyrian knight, you know, cursing the crab feeder to his face and thinking his prince was here to save him. And nah, man, you're just a landing pad.
I mean, that's the thing about dragons. They're a fairly indiscriminate weapon on a mixed battlefield. Like, you can't pinpoint the enemy very well. So if they can get in and just, I guess if they could break their lines and mix in with the rest of the armies, you'd have a hard time using a dragon to put that down.
Yeah, I believe they call that danger close when you call in fire support. Right on top of yourself to get the enemy. There's a lot of that going on in House Targaryen. But also you wonder, I'm curious to see how they conceive of armed forces going forward, because it seems like no one would ever do battle in an open field. So, and why would the Targaryens ever commit to a place to a whole bunch of, like, get their people massed together on either side, because they both have dragons? It's like, it seems like it's going to be almost like a submarine form of combat that they'd have to engage in. But
yeah,
I don't know. Maybe they can think of reasons. They'll bring out the old scorpions.
I wonder if we'll ever get insight into how the foot soldiers feel about that. You know, like, man, they killed. Yeah, the dragons came in and won the battle, but they killed a lot of us, too. A lot of us.
Right. I guess it probably comes down to how, if they won or lost, you know?
Sure.
And whose side has got, you know, like, when the dragon's burning the other guys, like, haha, this rules, when the dragon set you on fire, fuck, this sucks, you know, kind of that meme.
Sure. And I guess the ones who get set on fire aren't there to complain anymore, so.
True.
All right, let's go 3 years. Maybe a year into the future here. It's 3 years from where we left it last episode. There's a new male heir, Aegon, and he is celebrating his second name day. Viserys gets a report about how poorly the crab feeder siege is going, but he doesn't care to clean up his brother's mess. They're about to leave for Aegon's name day party or the royal hunt that's going to happen, but Rhaenyra is nowhere to be found. Like I said in the instant take, I was really playing catch up in this scene. It was a lot easier to follow the second time around.
But I had
so many questions, too. Like, not just things that, and things that aren't actually answered by the end of the episode. I don't know how the king's wounds are faring. I went back and I looked at his fingers. Those don't look like totally normal stumps to me. Those look like still rotting, kind of problematic stumps. It makes me wonder about what's going on with his back.
Kind of problematic, man. Stumps. The
if we
the
did Viserys episode
Targaryen
names.
Story.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. No, I think you're right. What do you think of Hightower's play here? It seems like it felt really aggressive, but when I think about, like, okay, it's been 3 years. I guess that this brother, you know, he's the Lord of Hightower, the older brother of Otto here, and he's saying you need to put the foot on the gas. Maybe that makes sense, but it just felt like Otto might be running just a little bit ahead of himself and irritating the king. But again, it's hard to tell because it's been 3 years, and it feels like Otto's maybe kind of laid low after his last victory.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if he's smart, he would. No need to push it. I don't know. The king. One of the things I appreciate about this episode is Patty Considine's performance as he gets more and more fed up with the politicking, as he puts it. Yeah. And how this genuinely joyful smile that he has at the beginning of this episode just gets more and more forced. Every time he's forced to interact with a lord who wants Rhaenyra's hand in marriage, who wants to give him a spear for their own glory and the killing of the stag, like, all this just adds up to him getting more and more fed up and frustrated. And the performance there is so good. It's so gradual. It's so natural to me.
Yeah, I've often read in books, like, you know, just describe someone's smile as curdling, you know, like milk. And I feel like there was a curdling smile exhibition put on just a fucking masterclass in the middle goings here by Patty. I just really felt bad for the dude, you know?
Yeah.
He's not even a bad king by Westeros. Mm-hmm. Like, name a better king that we've seen depicted on video in the show thus far. Like, fucking Robert? No. The Mad King? Joffrey? No.
Stannis? Like, no.
It's Stannis?
All the king wannabes? No.
Yeah, Mr. Burn his own daughter for no result. Like, he clearly at least gives a shit, and maybe he's a little bit weak. Maybe he's a little bit leans too much on his people's counsel, but, like, don't you want a king to be, you know, the guy's at least trying. And has what it seems like a fairly decent heart. And in fact, it seems like his biggest problem is he just doesn't trust his gut enough.
Yeah.
You know, which saddles him with a huge amount of regret and bitterness by this episode. But
he's kind of an opposite Jon Snow. I don't know. In some ways, in other ways, he's just like Jon Snow.
Yeah.
Neither of them seem to really want this.
They don't wanna. That's what he needs to speak a language they'll understand.
Mm-hmm. And we get some information that's going to be important later, right? About this battle going poorly. That's going to be kind of the crux of this whole episode.
Yeah, and there's two twin Lannister brothers. Tyland is the dull one, apparently, and Jason is the hot one.
Tyland is the one on the council?
Yeah, I don't think we've previously seen. I'm supposing that he is. I should have looked this up, but, like, I'm just now realizing, I left a lore stone uncovered. All right, I'm going to surmise that Corlys abandoned his post and went to the Stepstones so that he is the new master of ships.
Okay.
Since he seems like he's trying to, like, marshal, but he could be, I don't know, he could be some other role that they haven't introduced thus far. But that's what I'm guessing, because, like, Corlys is not around to do his duties.
Right. All right, let's go find Rhaenyra. Turns out she's under the Weirwood tree in the Godswood reading while her, I guess you'd call him a bard? I don't know. Plays her some songs.
Minstrel?
Troubadour, is that a thing? I think he could
be a troubadour, sure.
Allison arrives to fetch her for the royal hunt, and Rhaenyra would rather stay, but the king has ordered her to go, so she does. Whatever this bard troubadour guy is, he is another Samwell, which I found interesting. This is not any tie, as best I can tell, to Samwell Tarly.
But probably not, but it's just another kind of, like, dopamine hit for the old school Game of Thrones fans.
Sure.
He's singing a song about Princess Nymeria.
Oh, yeah. The namesake of Arya's wolf, huh?
Yep. The famous first princess of Dorne who led the people to Rhoynar over into Essos, fleeing the Valyrian Empire. It's I think it's the second time she's been name checked in three episodes. So again, if there is a Nymeria prequel in planning, which I think would be a good one, they're definitely laying the groundwork for it.
Are they drawing connections between Rhaenyra and her?
Well, so I was thinking about this, and it seems like, because one of the things criticism I had on my first watch is that, like, it looked like Rhaenyra was just being a shit. She's like, well, if no one's going to take me seriously, then fuck it. I'm not even going to try being a queen. I think you're supposed to understand that because she is definitely having Princess Namira played on repeat, like has her eye of the tiger, her feminist eye of the tiger. Like this is the woman who led her people and did all these great things and was taken seriously by the men and blah, blah, blah. But she's also hitting the books, you know, where she had to be forced to do that. The only problem with the character is, so I think you're supposed to understand that she is trying to polish herself into a leader while still being standoffish with her father and still being kind of like throwing shade at her former best friend. The only problem with that is, like, I always got that Rhaenyra didn't take the study seriously, but she was smart enough that she just picked it up anyway. Because, like, she wasn't ever caught out by not knowing anything, right? So,
well, imagine what she could do. I think that's what they're trying to go herself, for, right?
Right. Well, yeah, there's that. So,
yeah, Walter White.
I don't think she's. I still think she's unpolished. She's not very political in this episode, and that's unfortunate. But I do think, in her way, she is trying to prep herself to be a leader.
And that all, you know, turns to crap when she realizes that Jason Lannister has been basically foisted upon her by her father.
It's a foisting.
It's a foisting. Yeah.
Yeah.
And yeah, then she's just like full rebellion mode. But I think you're right. I think she's trying to fit in where she can here and make herself a better prospect for the throne.
And then, and like, I thought that they did the 3-year time jump really well, because last we saw these people, Allison, you know, is chewing her fingernails down to the bone. She's worried sick about this. She's like twisting in the wind between, you know, her king to be and her former best friend. And now we see that Allison is kind of not completely out of patience, because she is getting impatient. Mm-hmm. She's like, you know, strong arming Rhaenyra here. But also in many instances in this episode where she could slip the blade between Rhaenyra's ribs, she is actually stumping for her where it counts in front of her husband, the king. She's not taking Otto's advice to heart. She seems like she's still trying to. And like she said in the scene, like it doesn't need to be like this, Rhaenyra.
Yeah.
Like, do you, apparently they haven't had an honest conversation in 3 years, because it's like, look, I mean, I know maybe you can be mad at me for keeping the king's confidence above you, but he did kind of order me to. And also, what am I going to do? Say no? Say no to my dad? Say no to the king? You, mm-hmm. Like, come on. What the fuck? The other hand, I get it's a lot.
And I love the, you know, the change of dynamic that we knew had to come with her becoming queen. It's. I feel like it's a huge mistake when she tries to order Rhaenyra to do something in this scene, right? Mm-hmm. Like, she tries to use her power as queen to tell her to come to this party. And
especially since she knows better. She later tells Viserys, like, the way to get Rhaenyra to do something is to make her think it's her choice. Right. And she's kind of doing the opposite of that by coming in here. But again, it's been three years of this shit with her, right? You can imagine. Like, if anything, like, this is the calmest Rhaenyra has been about it. And she's being a real shit, you know? Like, the whole, like, was it order of the king? Yes. Well, then by all means, my grace, let's go at once. Like, she's really giving her the business here.
Right. And I don't know what the actual power dynamic is here. The heir to the throne, the princess, how much she has to listen to her mother, you know, her new mother. I don't know. Like, could Allison just be like, off with her head? I'm the queen, off with her head. And
I don't think so. Okay. But it's a good question, because the queen has a lot of like soft power,
right,
because she gets it like essentially reflected from the king. Right.
Sure. I mean, she has.
But it's like one of those things. As certain as I am that Allison couldn't just say off with her head and no one would comply.
Right. Viserys wouldn't let that happen.
But if Viserys dies and Rhaenyra does be made queen, like, I'm pretty sure Rhaenyra could on that day be like, take the queen mother and her children and throw them off a cliff or something. And everyone would do it. So,
yeah,
it's dangerous to be this at odds with the heir to be.
Yeah. I think some of that is going to be patched up by the end of this, honestly, the end of this episode. I think the conversation she has with Viserys later on could smooth over a lot of that, but we'll see.
Do you think reconciling with her father would reconcile her to Allison?
A little bit. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. All right. We're on to the ride to the name day celebration, where Viserys tries to remind Rhaenyra of her various duties, but he gets a lot of attitude. And the line that really stuck with me the entire episode is how she doesn't like killing boars because they squeal like children when they're being slaughtered.
But when she's pushed by a boar, god damn it,
right?
She will rise to the occasion.
Maybe don't be a mother then. if you're going to stab the boars when they come at you a little too hard.
So they start out this like, you know, it's like, oh, look at here, Rhaenyra, you're going to be with child soon. Something that we know from the first episode is not something Rhaenyra ever looked forward to. Mm-hmm. Not a great way to bond with her. And then is Alicent goading her? Is this one of the things where she's being loyal behind her back, but like kind of shitty to her face? Because they play this like it's a huge faux pas for her to be like, it's fine, Rhaenyra. Yeah, the days are long, but look at me. I had Aegon with no problems. Came right out, didn't kill me or nothing. Hmm. And you see the ladies in waiting going like, ooh. Yeah. And they cut to Viserys and he's going, ooh. and, you know, like it's just an awkward moment. Did she do it on purpose or is that just like...
I don't think so. I think there are a couple of faux pas, right? Because later on, Jason Lannister does a similar thing where he says, like, something about, would you turn down a whole bunch of new dragons? Like, you know, equating it to power. And then Viserys is like, oh, do you have dragons to offer? And he's like, well, shit, no.
Yeah, yeah.
So he kind of steps like, in it. I think that's her just, like, accidentally stepping in it.
Yeah. Saying something insensitive, maybe. Mm-hmm. Because that's clearly what everyone's thinking is like, well, we know the last queen had a lot, you know, a lot of trouble with this whole thing. It wasn't so simple.
Yeah. And that wound is, you know, still there. It's not as fresh now as it was last episode, but.
And there's also this, you know, it's all about the succession. Like the reason Rhaenyra is salty is because this is her brother's birthday and no one is here for her. They all swore fealty to her 3 years ago, but nobody's here.
And by extension, probably never. It's even worse, right? Because Viserys isn't even here for her. He's here for the heir, whoever that may be. And he's going to, in her mind, sell her off to get whatever scraps he can salvage from this former heir once he names Aegon.
And I wouldn't say it's misunderstanding because I do think that Viserys is still kind of like wrestling with like, God, did I make this an impetuous decision? And if I did make it, do I mean it? Like, am I giving up this dream of, you know, the slam dunk male heir that everybody loves and admires? Like, it's,
yeah, it's complicated. That's what I like. All right. They arrive at the name day celebration where they're greeted by dozens of lords. Rhaenyra roams the tents, gets noticed by Jason Lannister, then gets pulled into a conversation about her uncle's failing war, which she quickly puts an end to. Not the war, the conversation about the war.
We see the Lannister twins here together. We see the other strong boys. Yeah, we're gonna get to know Larys a little bit better. And we're going to hear a little bit about his brother, Bonebreaker, I think.
Breakbones. Harwin Breakbones.
What a
great
right.
nickname.
Yeah, yeah.
We see him, actually, I think, in the episode.
We do a couple times.
He's the one that
standing
gives that
here.
Crazed smile when Rhaenyra shows
he's
back
He's the
up.
Only one going like, yes, queen, when he sees her show up covered in blood. Yeah, like Breakbones is all about that shit. Yeah, but you see him standing here by his brother and his father as well. They name checked as Joanna Swan, who's gotten abducted. One of the reasons, because so like, you know, you'll recall in the first episode, the Westerosi men were kind of like, oh, wow, the Triarchy wants to clean up the pirate problem and Stepstones. Sweet. We don't even mind paying them a toll fee to get across there because shit, we don't want to deal with these pirates. What happens in the books is that eventually they keep on, the Triarchy competes to like who can extract the most wealth out of that passage. And Lyse, which is one of the three arms of the Triarchy, is known for their pleasure houses, their pillow houses. And they start taking like women, girls, and young boys off the ships to sell to try to ransom if they're a lord or just sell as slaves. And the Westerosi people get pretty hot. And this is one of them. And her father in the books mentioned that he was so kind of like cheap that he could have paid a pretty modest ransom to get his daughter out of Hawk, and he just didn't. So she gets shipped off to the pleasure houses of Lyse, and it'll be interesting to see if they follow up on that, because there's a little bit more to her story that even the book says it doesn't have anything to do with the main action, but it's kind of interesting. The other interesting political thing is this Lady Redwine that that Rhaenyra dunks on is House Redwine controls probably the second or third largest fleet in Westeros. You got the Valyrians, you got the Ironborn, and then somewhere in there you've got the Redwine fleet.
Okay.
And they remain a significant naval threat into the days of Robert's Rebellion and beyond. So, like, yeah, it's cool that you dunked on them, but, you know, with your uncle kind of like languishing and losing a lot of his perhaps naval strength and his sworn bannerman in the Stepstone adventure. And, you know, do you want to be pissing off this powerful house? Is that going to come, or any of these chickens going to come home to roost later?
Yeah. Especially if you're not going to take Lord Strong's advice. I feel like Lord Strong is becoming stronger and stronger through these episodes because, you know, he's got the advice to patch things up with Corlys by marrying Rhaenyra off to what's his name?
Laenor.
Thank you. And that makes a lot of sense, actually. But of course, we see by the end of this episode, he's going to let Rhaenyra choose who she wants to marry. And I doubt it's going to be Laenor. She doesn't even really know him as best as I can tell. So I don't know. Yeah, the alliances are going to be interesting going forward. I think there's an interesting nugget here with Alicent sort of trying to stand up for Rhaenyra in this conversation. Because Redwine's taken it to her at the beginning.
Yeah, and she's good, speaking above herself.
Yeah, but and then Alicent tries to step in kind of and soft...
Diffuse it.
But I don't think Rhaenyra likes that. I think Rhaenyra sees that as like, look, I can fight my own battle here.
Yeah.
Whether it's with the sword or the tongue.
Don't manage me. I don't need to be handled. Yeah.
And then she does.
I agree.
She puts down this conversation quickly. Yeah.
And Sir Larry Strong, Larys, you're just supposed to notice him, I think. You know, here's a guy, he's quiet, got his ears open, his eyes open. Sitting with the ladies, talking about the political intrigue,
mouthful of cake.
You know, just foot sideways, mouthful of cake. Just keep your eye on these strong boys. You're definitely supposed to be knowing them.
Okay. Jason Lannister tries to impress Rhaenyra with his wealth and his wine, and then offers to build her a dragon pit when they're married. Rhaenyra is unimpressed.
It's fun because I actually think this is a pretty decent way to pick up a Targaryen princess, man. Let's, you know, like, hey, I'm handsome, I'm well established, and I'm not above building a dragon pit for, you know, a 3-car dragon garage for you. It's just that Rhaenyra is not having any of this shit, and to her, it's further evidence that she's going to be supplanted. Why is my dad so hot to marry me off if he's not just trying to get whatever value I've got, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Trying to, it's like I'm trading in a used car before it rolls over 100,000 on the odometer. You know, it's like,
yeah. And I think this goes into, you know, what Viserys says about Rhaenyra with the reverse psychology you got to use on her, right? If it's your idea, it's a terrible idea. If it's her idea, right. She thinks, if you can make her think it's her idea, it's a great one. And anybody who walks up to her at this point, I think, and tries to pitch her on marriage is going to be turned down. Kristen Cole, anybody could walk up to her and make this pitch and they'd be turned down because it's their idea. She needs to be the one, I think, to initiate whatever is going to happen with.
Yeah, no, it's pretty bold. This guy who he says is, we haven't even met. I'm just going to propose a marriage alliance right here, right now.
Absolutely.
Instead of like getting to know her, you know, yeah, Rhaenyra is a lot like, if we're going to the Downton Abbey reference, she's a lot like Cousin Mary. You know, she's just does not want to be managed, does not want to kind of wants to do her own thing. I understand she has duties and obligations, but does not like to be reminded of it.
Yeah.
I just like this. I got the idea that Jason might be the first time in his life he's been told, like, just turned down cold.
Yeah, could be. His wealth and wine gets him nothing here.
Yeah.
All right. Rhaenyra goes back inside and tells off her father for trying to set her up with Jason. They argue loudly about it before Otto interrupts to say that they've spotted a white hart. which is a good omen. Rhaenyra rides off on her horse, and Kristen Cole goes after her.
Yeah, they have a flat out screaming match.
Yeah,
that everyone at court kind of notices, mm-hmm. and you know, probably are free to write their prejudices upon it. Like, oh, is the king telling her that you can imagine what they're whispering. Like, oh, he's probably telling her that you know, now that Aegon's too, she's going to be set aside, and or oh, they're bickering about what to do about Daemon. It's like it just doesn't look good. We've been told this entire season that House Targaryen looks weak from within and without, and you're seeing it right here.
Yeah, absolutely.
I was like scratching my head about this white stag, this white heart business, and I'm like, well, maybe this is like something that the Baratheons did, the Stormlords did before the Targaryens came along. And Ryan Condal copped to the fact that they just invented this. This is a repurposed Arthurian legend. You know, that this is tied to like King Arthur's court, and you know, at the beginning of his reign, a white hart came rampaging through Camelot and sent the knights on some quests that had some. This might be a topic I want to tackle for the Maester's Corner, but I thought that was interesting that they are going into broader Western culture to make new lore. Ryan Condal, he of the marble clock in system, is now inventing portents and signs for Westeros.
Sure. I like it. He's probably going to have to invent a lot of stuff for this show.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially since he's making, you know, a whole episode from two paragraphs in the book. Yeah. There's a lot of stuff to elaborate on.
Yep.
But also I just felt like this is where Otto really felt like you could feel Viserys get like, oh God, my hands are greasy after dealing with you. Like everything's just oily.
Because he touched the white stag poop. I mean, what do you expect?
It's the poop club.
Yeah.
Yeah. Someone on Instatake I think it was John from the Lorehounds saying like, you know, that Viserys has got this heart spore that he's rubbing on his hands and gloves. And no wonder you're losing fingers. You're touching people with that. but this Otto, like, I was never a man for portents, but if the gods wish to show the favor, like, just slow down. Slow down, Otto. Come on.
Yeah, I mean, Otto is not going to slow down. He's gonna put the pedal to the metal this episode.
He puts a gas. I'm telling you, it's like Viserys is, he looks like he's a race car in the red, man. He's going to throw a rod. You don't want to be in the room when that happens.
Indeed. All right, Kristen catches up with Rhaenyra some ways into the Kingswood. He's able to calm her with his charm, but not able to convince her to return to the celebration. They walk and talk about what's bothering her. She feels powerless. She can't make these decisions. Toothless, I think, is the term she uses.
Yeah. But, you know, I think he kind of like gets princess points for saying like, hey, you know, you might be toothless, but I owe my entire career to you. So,
yeah, not that toothless.
How many 17-year-old girls can say they made a knight's career in Westeros? Don't answer that question. Don't ask Mushroom to answer that question, because he might know.
Right. I do like the relationship that they're showing has developed off screen in the last 3 years. There seems to be a warmth here. I don't know. I was looking for the romance the second time around. Didn't really see it. I'm seeing more of just like a warm relationship between.
He's doing what Jason should have done. Just put in the time, get to know her.
I mean, if that's where they're going with it, definitely. This is the way to Rhaenyra's heart.
Remember that there's no way that this relationship can flourish in any kind of official capacity. He's a sworn brother of the Night's Guard. Right. Do you remember what that means?
It means no marriages,
no sex, no heirs, no holdings, mm-hmm. no lands, no titles, no nobility, nothing. Nothing.
All they get is Kingsguard.
They get to, I mean, it's a very prestigious position and you get a lot of swag points for it. But all you get to do is wear the white and die for the king or queen if you're lucky, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I'm with you. It's it looks like a doomed relationship if it ever turned into one.
Yeah.
All right. Viserys joins the royal hunt momentarily, at least long enough to feel the White Hart's poop. Then he goes back to the tent where he proceeds to start drinking. And Jason Lannister gives him a golden spear with which to kill the white stag. Then He makes the mistake of assuming that Viserys is going to name Aegon his new heir and gets told off. And Otto feels like this is the moment I need to swoop in with my absurd suggestion that Rhaenyra be married to baby Aegon. And Viserys literally laughs in his face. My God.
Is this
man.
A marketing tactic? Like when you offer someone just a clearly terrible solution sure. so that the next solution you offer immediately looks better by comparison?
Gotta be. Because this can't be taken seriously, right?
She's like, well, you know, if you're not willing to marry your daughter to the prince, who clearly will be heir. And I wonder where his next play is going to be.
You can't go much lower than this, honestly. Marrying, I guess it's half brother to half sister here. And that's certainly not the most egregious Targaryen marriage, I'm sure. But to a 2-year-old, a 17-year-old to a 2-year-old, I don't know about this.
That's rough even. I mean, I know it happened, but it's got to be rough for all involved, even in, I tell you, Patty Considine does some quality face work here.
Yes.
Like, I think that Jason Lannister is going up and thinking that this man is a fool. And that like, you know, obviously I'd spent a lot of time, but like he finds that there is a little bit of fire and blood in this man still.
Sure.
And if he wasn't real smart with how he used his tongue, he might find himself, gibbeted. I'm not sure. Dead bodied on public display.
Yeah, jibbed. Just blown it to 1,000 pieces. No, and it's funny, too, by the end of this conversation, he shuts his mouth, right? Like,
that's all you can
do. He's too afraid to respond in any way, because every time he's tried to respond in this conversation, it's been met with either it being turned around on him or fury or just something unexpected, so he just shuts up. I love it.
Yeah, it's a useful skill to learn if you're ever in a rigidly hierarchical structure, the ability to just eat a shit sandwich.
Yeah.
Regardless of the justice of it, because, you know, you're in a rigid hierarchy and you kind of have to. That smile, the eyes, I was talking about that. This is the curdled smile I was talking about where he hits Jason with after he's like, dresses this guy down. But thank you for your spear.
Mm-hmm.
I really appreciate it. Hit him with the grayscale smile.
Boy, let's talk about Otto for a second. Otto's really falling in my estimation. I thought he had some good ideas. I thought he was, protector of the king, advisor of the king. He just seems more and more unhinged. And I don't even know why he suggests this marriage to Aegon. I don't really know what purpose it serves. I feel like, I mean, Lord Strong is the one who is really impressing me in these past few episodes. He's got the right advice at the right time. He's patient. I think like him waiting until now until the king, I don't know, until like this issue has to be pressed a little bit. He's not in the king's ear the day after the death of his wife trying to tell him what to do. He waits for the king to come to him. Like, there's just a lot going on with Lord Strong that I really appreciate.
Do you think that Lord Strong is giving the rare and elusive leal service and advice to his king, or is he playing what you would call the long game? Where, like, I'm going, instead of Otto, I see Otto pumping the gas, I'm going to tap the brakes. And I know if I'm patient,
just be a counterpoint to Otto?
I'm going to, and Otto's going to, do you think it's more of just, he's just a man of the realm and he's trying to do good? Or do you think that it's a different strategy?
No, I think it's the former. I feel like Lord Strong really cares to do right by both the people and by his king. And yeah, at every turn, I think he's giving him the right advice.
Yeah, that's like I mentioned in the first episode that like that was his book reputation heading into this series, is that he was, you know, he let people think of him as being kind of slow-witted and thick, a man of few words. He did a lot of listening, but when he actually opened his mouth, it was something that men took seriously, you know, and he's actually very learned and educated. So
yeah,
I think you've got a good perspective there.
yeah, they're doing a great job laying it out for me. And it's going to be interesting because I think he wins Viserys's favor at the end of this, right? Like Viserys had an expectation of what Lord Strong was going to say to him in this moment.
He definitely. The thing is that Viserys is in his cups. So will he remember?
Sure.
But secondly, sure. Like, no, you when he leans against Lord Strong and like claps his poop hand on his shoulder.
It's not just to rub the poop off. Yeah,
it's not just to wipe the poop off. It's I think he's like leaning, like I'm like, man, I'm leaning on this guy. This master of law here is just got hit after hit. He's banging out. Also telling my royal personage, I told you so, in the most polite way possible, you know, about the match that he had already, like, he's the way he reminded him of, like, you know, I tried to tell you the last time, sir, maybe you don't remember. This isn't the first time I've come talking sense to you. He's doing a good job this episode for sure.
And then to find out that he has Harwin Breakbones as his son, the strongest knight in the land, according to Viserys here, I think is another added dimension. I guess I wouldn't have expected that. I would have expected his kids to be more like him. You know, not the what's the inverse of speak softly and carry a large stick?
Be a loud asshole and carry the littlest stick in the world.
Okay, it's not quite that. I mean, apparently Breakbones got a big stick, but you know, I guess I wouldn't have expected that. So a lot of layers to this family. I'm very interested to see what they do in the future. And knowing this show, they'll probably just be wiped out by Dragonfire or something like next episode. But who knows? All right, we already kind of talked through the next scene where Viserys continues drinking very heavily into the evening and Lord Strong offers his opinion on who to marry Rhaenyra to. And his suggestion is Laenor Velaryon, thereby reuniting him and Corlys, which is important.
Yeah, like, you know, the to put it mildly, he almost says that the breach between the two houses has not narrowed. This would do a long way to...
Yep.
You know, but he definitely, the king suspecting, self-serving, glad-handing, and he gets sage counsel and he can truly, truly appreciate it, it seems. But man, the king is having, it's a bad place to be when you're drinking so much, it gets in the way you're drinking. Like where you can't physically pour more wine, can't hit the
target, the container. I mean, that's what he's got servants for, right? Come on. The servants get you optimally drunk. That's the point of them.
And I think they made it a point of showing, like, Alicent noticing all this, too. Like, she's seeing this dark. And I also, like, man, this guy is so lonely. Why doesn't he feast with his wife and his child? Mm-hmm. Why doesn't he, like, pick a table, like, you know, have, like, more of a lord's table kind of a thing?
Thinking over his decision, right? He's stewing on this. So that's
his decision. He wanted to be with a Kingsguard kind of, like, you know, gating presence to him.
Okay. I think so.
That makes sense.
Yeah, he's really having a crisis of conscience here. I do want to know, I hope we get information in the future on how Breakbones got his nickname. That would be fun, because I can't imagine. I assume it's something to do with, like, I don't know, a tournament gone wrong or gone right for him, where he just, like, bests everybody and...
Yeah. He's like the Wiki of Ice and Fire describes him as the strongest man in the Seven Kingdoms in his day. He's described as being massive and redoubtable, which is a cool word, redoubtable. It means like it's kind of like a it's saying the person's formidable, but tinged with like awe and respect, know, like you're, it's almost fear inspiring how formidable they are. That gives you an idea of his character going into the series.
I feel like that's rough, considering I've seen The Mountain, considering I've seen both
of his day.
Yeah, but you're telling me there's no mountain-like character. There's no even like hound type characters out there.
It's interesting because like
he
honestly
hasn't seen that big.
There are definitely big characters in the world of Ice and Fire, but I'm struggling to think of one in this era. Maybe this is the Breakbones of the era, but of course, like as you say, he's no mountain.
Close.
This is the mountain of his era. He's not, but he's not that. Sir Duncan the Tall, which pals around with the Egg and the Duncan Egg series. Sometimes people thought he could be the like grandsire through some way of Brienne of Tarth. He's like a notably huge, massive person, but he's not going to show up for about another 70 so years.
Hmm. Okay. I'll take their word for it for now.
I thought he gave like a beefy Bradley Cooper vibe.
Yeah. Yeah, I could see it.
A little bit of Greek mixed in there.
Sure. All right, Rhaenyra still doesn't want to return to the celebration. She sits around a fire talking with Kristen. Something spooks the horses, and Kristen gets up to deal with it. And a boar charges out of the woods and attacks Rhaenyra, and they tag team it and kill it.
It's kind of wild that she, it says something about her that she's able to fend off a wild boar attack. Like, he's just trying to gore with her tusks, and she wasn't having it. Then to be fair, you know, Sir Crispin there jumped in with his sword and did a lot, but she ends up having to put the guy down. I thought it was
extremely dangerous move with that sword, by the way. He stabs right through the boar's head, right at her face.
Fair point, but on the other hand, that boar was just seconds from goring his sworn charge. So it's like, well,
yeah,
you know. She's definitely going to die by pig. Maybe she'll die by my sword. We'll see. I'm probably a dead man either way if that happens.
Sure.
Do you think... What did you make of their conversation where she's like, I'm worried that the realm won't accept me as queen, and Sir Kristen responds, well, they'll have to.
Is this the same thing that the Rhaenys told her? Or the, mm-hmm. the Rhaenys... This is the opposite of what Rhaenys told her. Rhaenys said,
yes,
they won't accept you. And Rhaenyra was like, well, I'll make them accept me because I'll be queen. She's like, that won't happen.
Do you think that this is like she's recognizing that there is like something fundamentally in conflict with her worldview, that like she doesn't want to be ordered and made to do things, and she's resentful, and she's starting to realize that like, oh my God, there's a lot of lords that don't want to go along with this, and you know, I know how I act when I said I'm forced to do something. How would a proud lord or lady be? Do you think there's like a realization that she's making there?
I suppose there could be,
because certainly it's like, you know, the opposite of doing to others how you'd want them to do into you.
Yeah,
rules for thee, not for me.
I think that's more accurate. I don't think she's that self-aware of her own emotional internal state at this point. I think like she's just angry about the situation more than she is internalizing any of this stuff.
I do wonder if they're starting to show like a turn there, because like she got real thoughtful once he said that. Also like the idea, like as they wake up covered in gore, I like the idea that they just went to sleep like this.
Yeah.
It's like, whew, man, know, it's stabbing been a hard the night. Shit out of that took a lot out of me. I think I was going to turn in. I'm a little sticky. Do you have any wet wipes? No. Okay. Well, good night.
Like, yep.
There's not a stream nearby.
White. We saw one.
Your pure white cloak can't wipe blood off the princess's face. Come on.
Right. We also have to bring back the treason scale. You know, we talked about this with Daemon and Corlys and all that, but on the treason scale of 1 to 10, how treasonous is it to say, even playfully, his grace can worry himself to death if he so likes? How's that on the treason scale for you?
It's pretty light. It's pretty light treason, to be honest, because it's not, you're not saying that you're taking action. You're saying that you would allow his grace to worry himself to death. Mm-hmm. You know,
you wouldn't
it's
do anything
also
to stop
his daughter,
it.
The heir, kind of like, yeah, I don't think it's an I think the Kingsguard would consider that an actionable threat.
Probably not.
I'm gonna give it a 1.5.
OK, there are less treasonous things you can do, but there are certainly
because like it would be a zero if there was no enmity between her father, but they're kind of at odds. So like these kind of are kind of dainty, but like, yeah, I'll
also,
give it a
this
1.
Is the
5.
Heir saying that, you know, if he does worry himself to death, guess who's queen?
She's going to be benefiting from it. Yeah. Maybe a 2. Maybe we're up to 2.
Okay. Perfect. So let's talk about the boar a little bit more. Is there any connection here to Robert Baratheon? He was famously gored to death by a boar.
I think that is yet another. I don't know to what end. Maybe it's just like, hey, you remember season one of Game of Thrones? Here's a bunch of comfy Game of Thrones season one vibes we're going to give you.
Okay.
It might just be that.
The other thing about the boar is that line that stuck with me from a previous scene, that they scream like children when they're stuck.
Yeah.
And here she's the one sticking it. And we actually have, you know, this 2-year-old child who's kind of at the crux of this episode, who is the source of her consternation in this episode. And boy, sure, she really goes to town stabbing this boar. I feel mm-hmm. like there's a lot of emotion being poured into that from the situation with Aegon.
That's such a mildly interesting take, Jim. I got to hand it to you.
How treasonous is it to knowingly stab to death a boar who in your mind represents the future heir to the throne?
Boy, you got to do a lot of proving of intent there. If I'm a Westerosi prosecuting attorney,
Lord Strong could get it done. He could make that connection.
Yeah, he might. Master of law, he might. Mm-hmm. He might. But I do think it's interesting because, like, you remember how the Robert got himself killed by letting Lancel Lannister, gods, what a stupid name, ply him with wine, maybe even drugged wine, to the part that he was so drunk he couldn't defend himself from a boar. And I think it is interesting that, like, you see Viserys, Robert Baratheoning it up, but his daughter's staying sober and she's able to. So, like, there's also maybe they're painting her as a worthier king because I think the strong drink plus boar hunting, it's hard not to make those associations.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
Can we clear this up? Would she be king or queen?
She'd be the queen.
Yeah. Okay. I wasn't certain if, like, you know, that thing where, like, you call officers sir even when they're women would apply to a kingship or queenship.
Got to show respect to officers even if they're women, Jim. Turns out it's a whole part of the unified military code of justice or something.
Something like that.
Big deal.
All right, let's go over to a very drunk Viserys telling Allison about his dream of a male heir and how he pursued it until he lost faith. And that's when he named Rhaenyra his heir. Now he's questioning whether that might have been a mistake. And then he hears a horn in the distance and stops drinking.
I couldn't stop thinking, like, Viserys, he's just gazing into his burning logs. Like, he's like, you know, Burning Man's gone to shit ever since they started letting the trust fund kids come out in the RVs with their generators. It's just not the same. It's just not the same. We used to come out here and get a good fucking burn on. And now look at us feasting, double headed boars. This was a great drunken regret speech.
It's
by a
fantastic
king.
Yeah.
Who has caught between wanting to be this exceptional leader and the reality of, like, you're kind of probably just mediocre. You succeeded the best king that the Targaryens have probably ever sat on the throne, arguably maybe the best that ever has sat the Iron Throne. Mm. And you're not bad. You're not a Joffrey. You're not a Robert. You're taking interest, you know, but he wants to be not just a dragon rider, which is a pretty exclusive club, but a dreaming Targaryen, someone that actually saves the world through their vision. And he doesn't want to give that up.
I find that interesting, too, when you look at what has been passed down to him, right? This prophecy from, was it Aegon the Conqueror? Is that the long winter thing,
right?
With the Night's King and all that stuff. Night King,
Song of
Ice and Fire. He might have a little bit of prophecy envy. Like, he's trying to hold on to his prophecy, or what he views as a prophecy in this dream, with the male heir being crowned. I think it's so good because they've done such a good job in the just short time that we've had with this series so far to tell us how important that dream was to him and how he let it go and how much he's regretting that. And it seems like each episode has been like the next stage of that. And here it's all kind of coming to a head. And I think,
but it's something he keeps going.
It's been kind of really well told.
Yeah, because it's also something he keeps going back and forth on. Like,
sure,
this dream was an obsession. It killed his mom, not in the sense that, like, if he'd made a different choice, she wouldn't have died that day. But clearly, you get the idea that he pressured her to, like, come on, let's keep trying. Let's keep trying. We need a male heir. Let's keep trying. That, after all the, you know, the rivers of blood out of that woman, you know, killed her just as much as the Maesters did. And he's like, you know, if I had just gone with Rhaenyra, what I did, she could still be alive. And
simultaneously, I gave the dream up too soon because now I have,
like,
the male
I got
heir.
The son, like, and like, what if there is the white heir? And it's like I don't know if you've ever had friends like these, but I've got a friend or three who I think are a little bit too woo for their own good and like take shit like tarot cards and fortune telling seriously. And sometimes they make serious life decisions based on this shit. And I'm always like, oh my fucking God. Well, it's your life and you can use whatever criteria, but you know. And I feel like the same thing with Viserys is here's a man who really believes in these signs and portents. And he's got this white heart staring down. I'm like, Jesus Christ, on my son's name day in the King's Woods. What if?
Yeah, this is the gods trying to tell me something.
Yeah, and he's just one of those guys who's just gonna like, well, shit, you know, it says I'm miserable in my job and I got this hot new offer, but man, the horoscope says it's just a bad time for change. Guess I'll let it pass. Like, it's
And the context of Dreamer is interesting too, because when I think of Dreamer, I think of someone who follows their passions, who lives a life unlike most people, and that's a good thing, a positive thing. You want people to follow their passions in life, but. Yeah, and so when I hear him say, like, giving up that dream, it's a sad thing, but simultaneously, it's the smart thing in his situation. And so I'm torn on this, too. I think it's they've done a very good job of, in my mind, of characterizing who this guy is and the internal tensions they're pulling at him. I think it's just really well done. And scenes like this and scenes like him apologizing to Rhaenyra later in this episode are just fantastic.
Yeah.
You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk podcast where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is rewarding to itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today.
We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't the joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for a podcast that really spoke to them, or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love. Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun, fan-favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info.
All right, let's move on to Viserys being taken to where they've pinned down a stag. It's not the White Heart, but it is a big one. And he takes Jason's spear and kills it. This is almost a relief for him, I think, in some ways, that it isn't right. The White Stag.
Yeah.
Because I don't know. There's a lot of symbolism in killing this thing, in just a White Heart being there. That's, I think, complicated.
I think it's interesting because there's also... this could be a partial allusion to his wife. You know, this is another innocent thing being held down and killed under his direction, kind of messily. It's something that's like purposeless and it doesn't, you know, matter. Something he's very ambivalent about. He's so drunk he can't even get this animal a clean death. I thought there's some interesting details because, like, I got my answer about the status of his fingers, but when he's holding on that spear, his bottom two fingers are sticking straight up because clearly there's no fingers in there to curl. There's a lot of, it's like he's maybe not as sure-handed because that's changed his grip or whatever, but I just got, you wake up massively hungover, and the way that I thought, the way they did the camera, like, because I thought the heart looked white when it was backlit by that light, and then you get a good look at, oh, it's brown. And the opposite, because of the golden hour light that we're seeing, when you first saw the White Heart, it looked brown. I thought that was interesting, the way they're kind of like, tricking your eye that way.
Yeah.
But I just feel like, what would it be like to be that hungover, that feeling like a shit, that kind of like surprised, relieved, disappointed? You try to kill this thing, all your men are watching, you're making a butchered show of it, and then they clap. I talk about this in the instant take. Like, if you've got an ounce of fraud complex in you, and I think Viserys has more of a pound, if not a stone's worth. Yeah. This has got to just set that on edge, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you are getting applauded for making a poor show of this gross perversion of the concept of a hunt and being a huntsman.
Yeah. Yeah, no, he definitely, all eyes on him in this moment is not pleasing him. I do have to ask, because there is a lot of, you know, Baratheon-esque stuff happening here with the boar and Robert. Now, are they doing anything here with this Lannister weapon being used to kill a stag, which is the sigil of House Baratheon? If it is, it's almost ironic in a way, right? Because that's going, we know that eventually Robert Baratheon turns the tables on the Targaryens. So, you know, this is almost like the opposite of a positive portent.
Yeah, it's definitely a foreshadowing for things in Robert's day. Is a foreshadowing events that happen later in the series? That's a mildly interesting question. We'll have to see.
Okay. That is interesting. All right, the White Stag may not have been... White Heart may not have been killed by Viserys, but it does show up near Rhaenyra and Kristen. She does not want to kill it, though. She lets it go, and they return to the celebration, then eventually to King's Landing.
It's funny, on the official podcast, Jason and I can't remember his co-host, one of the people from one of the NPR nerdcasts, they were acting as if this was a deliberate act of mercy, like that she understood the significance of the White Heart and that she just decided, like, I don't need to hunt this thing. I already got the boar. I'll let it go. Boy, if so, that's just so incredibly foolish. And I think that it's easy to put her as like, you know, she's kind of acting like a brat. She's kind of acting very foolish. But I think by the end of the episode, you understand a lot better from her sense what kind of like fatalism, political fatalism has kind of settled in.
Like, is she really going to kill this thing and bring it back and say, look, I'm the true heir? Or
it would be a fucking power move. It'd be what Damon would do.
It absolutely would. But also it's like, why bother? Like, I know how this is going, right? My dad's trying to marry me off at every opportunity. He's got a new heir. Like, none of this matters. It's pointless. Why kill this thing?
Yeah.
For naught, you know?
Damon would kill it. He would skin it. He would wear its cloak into the camp. He'd go further. He would find a brown ass deer and throw it in a tub of Clorox, then bring it back.
Sure.
Reeking of bleach. Look at this white heart I slew. Yeah, no, it's if she knew the significance and just decided to stay her hand because, I don't know, it'd be interesting to see if they're setting up a theme of her being overly merciful or overly trusting. Yeah,
that's what I wonder.
Yeah.
I don't know. We'll see.
I do love when she came back to camp, like they're just panning around at everyone's faces. You've got like
Jason
Lannister going like, oh God, oh gross.
Glad and she then didn't got, accept my hand in marriage.
You got Harwin Strong. And he's like, yes, I want to bed that woman. Yeah.
All right. Otto sits with Allison and stresses about stresses the importance of Viserys naming Aegon his heir. Allison then goes to Viserys' chambers to discuss it with him, but they ended up talking about a letter he got from Corlys Brothers saying they're losing the war in the Stepstones, and Allison simplifies the issue for him.
Yeah. Again, Otto putting the pedal to the metal with his daughter now, being like, this isn't just political pride, child. The realm's going to burn if Rhaenyra doesn't see... If the king, forget Rhaenyra, if the king doesn't see wisdom and reason, it's going to destroy the realm. And you're not looking at this as like, because she's like, well, what kind of son am I raising if he's just going to go and usurp his sister? And he's like, no, she's the one that's like, by all laws of man and God, it's Aegon that should be, you know, she's stealing from him. Just really.
Yeah.
And you can tell, like, I think that she doesn't want to defy her father, but if you. The things she actually says to the king seem to be definitely more supportive of Rhaenyra than Otto. Otto would be very disappointed to find out the contents of their conversations, it seems like.
Yeah, I sense a growing rift here between Allison and Otto. I think she does not appreciate him pushing so hard to replace Rhaenyra. You know, him saying this thing about, like, to deny Aegon is to assail the laws of God and men. Conspicuously, who's absent from that sentence? Women. I find that interesting. I don't think Allison appreciates that. I think as he pushes harder and harder, everyone's getting fed up with him. The king, Allison, everyone. He better be careful.
That's the big lie a lot of people push. It might be closer to the truth than Otto's type of, but like, no matter what happens, Aegon's going to be king. Okay, so like, we can take the door with more blood or the door with less blood, but it's inevitable. Like, you know, a lot of people use that. Exactly. Like, it's a way to kind of like sap your strength to fight. It's like nothing you can do. You can make it harder, sure, but you're not going to delay the inevitable.
Right.
I don't think that Allison is buying what he's selling at this point, though.
Yeah, I don't think so. And it's telling that, you know, she goes to speak with Viserys, and when the conversation never turns to, you know, who the heir should be, she doesn't, at least as much as we see, she doesn't ever bring it up. She doesn't address it at all, right? Otto sent her in to convince the king.
If anything, she gives him advice on how to handle. It's like, look, if you want to handle my former friend Rhaenyra, you got to let her. You got to let her set the tempo. You got to let her call the dance. You know, you can't dictate the shit to her. Because I also think she knows Rhaenyra enough to know that Rhaenyra is pretty dutiful. If she thought it was like going someplace, she would, you know, take something seriously. But she also very much should, you know, wants to keep her own counsel on stuff, which is weird because she's so much different from her father in that respect. Her father is much like just, oh, someone tell me what to do. Rhaenyra is like, no one should tell me what to do.
Yes, totally. That's accurate. I do wonder if there's more to this conversation, because we just kind of cut away from it, right? And the next scene is interesting. We see Viserys making a couple of decisions. He takes her advice on what to do about Daemon's failing war, and he decides to send aid to him. And then he makes the choice to apologize to Rhaenyra and not replace her. And I wonder if that was part of the counsel that he got from Alicent as well, just after the conversation ended from our perspective. I mean, that's my question. My active question now is, how much is Alicent actually advocating for the things that Otto wants, and how much does she have her own agenda here?
Yeah.
And I guess we'll find out. speaking of those decisions, Viserys decides to send aid to Daemon. He apologizes for pushing marriage on Rhaenyra and tells her to find her own match. He also makes a vow that he will not replace her as heir. I like the compromise he comes to here. It's not that he's going to stop pushing for marriage, right? Because he sees that as a vital, important, necessary thing for her to do as the heir. He's simply going to let her make her own decision about it. He's not going to push it.
Yeah.
And I think that's the right way, right? This is the thing that Alicent told him. Like, you need to let Rhaenyra have a say in this decision.
Yeah. No, and I think he's taking the tact that I try to take with my teenage son, which is like, I very rarely say, like, you absolutely cannot do this, although I'm not above it. But it's more of like, hey, I just want you to know what this looks like. You know, like, you can pull this shit with your dad and I'm going to love you forever because, like, you know, it's part of the whole deal. You try this shit with a roommate or a girlfriend or something and they're going to send you packing, man.
Yeah.
Because, like, think about it from their perspective. Think how disrespectful. Think how rude and inconsiderate this is. Okay, Dad. But, like, him saying, like, you know, like, hey, look, I'm not immune from this. I had to marry your mom at 17 so we could get this army from the Vale.
Yes. Finding this common ground is great. Right.
But it also turned out great for me. And unlike my parents, I'm going to let you make this choice yourself. I'm going to, like, you need to do it. And you know you need to do it.
Yeah.
But it's going to be your choice. Go out and find the man that makes you happy.
And Viserys realizing what a hypocrite he would be forcing her, forcing like a specific person on her, right?
And I think there's like, she's like, I can't believe my dad is being this cool. And she's kind of tearing up and she turns to go. And then he says, like, look, I did waver at one time, but now on your mother's memory, I promise you won't be supplanted.
Yeah.
I think she does, like, that final thing that won her over. She thinks that this is something she can, because, like, my dad is many things, but he's not going to invoke the memory of my mother and betray it. We'll see if she's right. But
and that conversation they had last episode helped tremendously for us to understand that, right? Just how much they both loved the Aemma. What a betrayal it would be if he did go back on it now. So I think you're right. And, you know, there is multiple levels to this. This conflict here, it's that he made his own decision to marry Alicent and that was wild, and now he's trying to force a specific person on her, but
right, because she definitely threw it back in his face. It's like, oh, like you did with Alicent. And he's like, and there's another good teenage parenting guideline: sometimes you gotta let him win, because what the fuck does it look like if you can't be like, you know, you did, you caught me being a hypocrite. And
but the other part of that is he was doing his duty, right? And he uses that, he applies a little bit of pressure there to say, yes, I married who I wanted and not who the realm would have me marry, but I was doing my duty. I had to be married for the good of the realm. Yeah. And so do you, you know, and that's a much softer sell.
And it's good for you too. Strengthen yourself.
Absolutely.
Become,
yeah.
Multiply,
when I'm gone,
make it, protect yourself. Just like I'm trying, you know, this. Yeah. He's doing a good job of selling the statesmanship of it.
Yeah. It's a fantastic scene all around. And then we go to the final scene, couple of scenes here.
Oh, before we move on, I want to say that I, for one, hope that this shuts the door on Viserys sidelining Rhaenyra, because it seems like in the last two episodes, she just like blossoms when he starts giving this like kingly advice and guidance and mentoring to her. And she gets, you know, sullen and angry when he kind of pulls back and stops doing that and just starts treating her like, oh, you should just have a bunch of kids, Rhaenyra. You should get a husband, Rhaenyra. You should do that. And I because this, they've kind of had this resolution at the end of the last two episodes, and I hope this is firmly putting, like, I want to see her actually being on the King's Council,
making suggestions,
rubbing people the wrong way, and him backing her. I want to see that, because if they do, that's like, man, I'm going to start thinking they're on a treadmill if they don't. But I think they will. I think the show is telling us Viserys is putting some real strength behind these words.
And I think there's a real opportunity here for her to start getting in the gap between Otto and Viserys, because Otto has been shown. I mean, the Allison thing was fine, but he doesn't even know Otto was really involved in that. The suggestions that Otto has been coming up with, the advice he's been giving him, has been universally bad. For her to sort of wedge in there and become his most trusted confidant, I think is a big opportunity for her.
Yeah, Otto's dug in there like a tick. She needs to extract him.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, boy, it's amazing how much I've turned on Otto in these last two episodes.
He's just,
I didn't
man,
think he was bad,
like,
in the first one, but whew.
And it's like his brothers gave him bad advice. Like, I just think this is the wrong time to, you know, be this obvious and this insistent. And even when the king is in his cups and belligerent, to keep on pushing.
Yeah.
But he feels, you know, he's got that second son inadequacy. And, you know, it's going to be, it's going to be interesting to see how he deals with Daemon now when Daemon is triumphant. And he's kind of like maybe on the low key outs with the king. Yeah, it's going to be real interesting to see what happens when Daemon comes back victorious.
Yeah, I'm curious at the greeting he gets. Like, will Viserys be,
especially
a
since
bit
the
tempered?
King? Yeah, because the king was already for kind of like forgiven. The fact that he beats him, I think, because like my understanding was Viserys always has a giant soft spot for Daemon. Mm-hmm. And definitely gets mad at him when he steps out of line and causes him trouble, but like wants Daemon to be, like, he's always looking for Daemon to grow up and turn the corner and be an asset, rather, you know, bring more things to the table than he takes off. So like, I think, I don't know, we might have an episode or two where the king and his brother are not at odds.
That might be nice. I don't know. We'll see. Then you got Corlys in the equation. It's all
sure. It's all there's rough, a lot of but. There's that's what's so fascinating about this era is like the shifting balances of personal favors and benefits and alliances is like constantly shifting.
Yeah, it's exciting.
Yeah.
All right, let's go over to the Stepstones, where the situation looks bleak. There are commanders fomenting mutiny. Potentially. And then the worst of it comes when Daemon gets a message of aid from his brother. He decides, you know what? I'm going to go deal with this crab eater before the aid arrives. He manages to draw. Sorry, crab eater. I called him crab eater too. You know, it's the circle of life,
eater,
man. You eat a few crabs, you feed a few crabs, life goes on. Anyway, he manages to draw out the crab feeder and destroy his army with dragons, then following him into the caves and killing him.
Oh, we just recapped the whole episode. Okay, I see.
I mean, it's action. What do you want, right?
I thought, so this is interesting. Daemon whipping the messenger, beating the messenger half to death. I thought that was interesting because it's another thing where they used a detail from earlier in this books to fill in, you know, like I said, the single paragraph that was essentially the outline for this episode. Daemon, when he found out that Viserys remarried as a young king, whipped the shit out of the messenger in that situation when he got that message on Dragonstone, which we, you know, we kind of jumped forward and we skipped that, but they wanted that volcanic temper, this idea that he is. And I thought Matt Smith played this awesome. He gets this and he like just opens it and he's like considers it and he like delicately, like with his pinky out, rolls it back and hands it to the messenger. And it just makes a sudden outburst of violence that more shocking.
And I like the shot when he first comes to the stone, takes off his helmet and sets it down, because it does a close up on the helmet.
Yeah.
I was like, why is that significant? Oh, we found out.
Also, this messenger boy, this Sir Adam, might be Adam Valerian, which could be a guy to keep to keep an eye on. I'm not sure if they're trying to allude to that guy or not. His name, they did identify him as a Sir Adam. But we'll see.
I mean, if he's a Valyrian, he's related to the several Valyrians standing there.
Yeah, that's what's why it might be, because like
Daemon beat the shit out of him with.
Well, the thing is like, I wonder if this, because that was my, if this guy was like nobody, I don't know why they would step in to check the king's brother from doing shit.
Sure.
You know? Sure. Like, that's dangerous. That'd be a dangerous thing to do, to lay hands. But like, that's kind of makes a sense if he is like some type of affiliation with the House Valyrian. They're like, hey, yo, you can't, you know, it's kind of the difference between just beating some. If you're a made man, you can beat some random punk up on a corner.
Sure.
But you can't beat like the boss's nephew's favorite cousin. That'll get you some shit. Right. So there's a lot of interesting Fredo, lore stuff.
He deserves it.
Right. Yeah, even Mo Green can't get around to slapping him out, and not even in Vegas, not even at the far from the prying eyes of New York. They also mentioned Dwarfstone, the fortress that is their base of operations. That is invented for the show. That doesn't exist because, again, single paragraph description of the war. Yeah, they also introduced this Vaemond Valyrian guy who, in the books, he has a bit of a role to play in Fire and Blood. But as we saw, they kind of like really yada yada'd the whole war against a crab feeder. And in the books, he's Corlys's nephew, not his younger brother.
Oh.
So to me, this feels like
Martin a lot of that? Times. That's strange.
Hmm?
Martin allowed them to change that? That's so, like, so conservative, that's lineage and stuff.
That was one of my questions, because like a lot of times, you know, you can lean on like, well, the maesters have different sources, who knows who's right, who's wrong, or there's only a sentence and we're going to elaborate. But this felt like a deliberate change and expansion of a role. Like, the only reason you would make a guy brother instead of nephew is to make that relationship closer so you can do more interesting things with it. But you're right, like if Martin is all Twitter-pated about some minor Targaryen king's lineage, but, you know, the Valyrians, you just get the stunt on, I guess.
I guess. I don't know. Speaking of stunting on the Valyrians, I love this Master of Complaints line. That was pretty good.
Yeah. I thought this scene in the background, too, of the ships kind of like getting attacked as you pan out, and you pan out the single shot and you see them having the war council right in front of it. So, like, I understand you hide from dragons in the mountains and in the hills and in the caves, but how the fuck do you get access to siege equipment capable of sending those giant pots of Greek fire or whatever to burn down those ships? The dragons are circling overhead with fire support.
Right.
Like, can you roll out a whole catapult or trebuchet and get it set up and fire in 60 seconds? Because
I don't like much about this battle, actually. I think the only thing I really like is it thematically.
Yeah,
makes a lot of sense for Daemon, but man, the logistics of it make damn near zero sense to me.
Yeah, but you know, that's the thing. It's like, I don't know. I feel like people should hire military advisors, not just for like, oh, you keep your finger straight to show good discipline and you cock your gun like this, but also just
don't
like,
blink when you shoot, right? That kind of stuff.
Yeah, like can you come up, and it's a minor thing, and it probably, like, the vast majority of these people that watch this are going to see, oh, the ship's on fire and Daemon being a badass and it's cool, but like, man, I think it'd be 5-10% cooler if this stuff actually made sense. You know,
yeah, I want it to hang together when you think about it for a second, for more than a second.
Right. I mean, like, the idea that, like, you know, maybe they're in caves, but they got flaming arrows and it's like more of a nuisance. Like, you, like, one out of every 10 ships coming through here might get set ablaze. But it looked like it was just like, yeah, 3 out of 4 ships are trying to go through this pass are just going to get fucking torched, which also doesn't make sense from a piracy standpoint.
Yeah.
You know, if you're actually extracting, but I guess you're at war at this point, you're no longer just extracting. Anyway, it's a bit of a mess.
Daemon and Corlys are getting outrationed by an army cowering in caves. They're talking about how we don't have enough food to keep up a siege. That's not how sieges work. It's the other side, the ones who are being sieged that are supposed to run out of rations. You people are doing this all wrong.
Yeah, and then like, how everything about Corlys this battle is still one of the wealthiest men in the Seven Kingdoms, so he can't afford to buy meals ready to eat. Like,
those sell swords apparently cost a kingdoms and also worth of
they
gold.
They mentioned that like there's like a reverse jetpacking where they're talking about like, well, the ships are at the drift mark but they're weeks away. Bull fucking shit is at a week sail from the, you know, mouth of the Blackwater Bay to the Stepstones. Get the fuck out of here.
The more I dwell on this the less I like it.
Let's not think too hard about it and just glide over it.
The last thing I want to say about it before we do talk about some of the cooler stuff is this is the easy part to get right. To me, they're getting all the hard stuff right and getting this easy stuff wrong. You can logistically make a battle work. It's not a matter of like, oh, does this play to an audience exactly how we want it to? Is this facial expression going to line up with this line we wrote? That's the hard part. What they're doing what they're fucking up is the easy part. And I don't know why.
They're fucking up the part that you can fix with like two or three sentences in the establishment of a scene in the script. Yes. Like, cause you're right. Like, this action is masterfully done. At no time did I have a question about where Damon was, where he came from, where he was in relation to his goal, where the guys were coming from, where the archers were, the overall strategy and lay of the land, and him moving across it felt like a natural progression. You look like you're watching the storming of Normandy on it's a one man storming of Normandy from Saving Private Ryan.
Yeah, that's
like
exactly.
He's moving up the beach towards an objective. He gets to the end and he's surrounded. They've successfully launched a trap. Here comes the Valyrians and the dragons. It's just, I wish the dude was wearing plate and a helmet and a shield, and I wish that they made it clear that this was them wanting to they had it right there, like, we got to break the siege. We could starve these guys out, sure, but my brother is going to send ships and take our credit.
We
need to do it right the fuck now. We need to push the issue. That's all they had to do, and I wouldn't have these questions.
I felt like they got to that place. I understood that that's why Damon made the choice he makes, but the thing I didn't understand was all the background logistic details about this siege. Like, why can't they wait these people out on food? Why are they the ones starving? Why haven't the dragons destroyed their trebuchets? Why haven't...
Yes.
Like, all of that stuff did not make sense. It was the smaller details...
Yes.
And the finer points of the episode, the trickier parts that they're getting right. And they just botch this easier stuff in my mind. But anyway,
it was very technically competent, certainly. It really was. Like, if they had, And it's good portents for battles to come, because I think this show is going to be much more battle heavy than your average Game of Thrones season.
Sure. I love seeing Corlys with this big ass battle axe chopping fools. That was awesome.
I like, it's almost like it's like a some kind of hybrid between like an axe or a short halberd or a glaive, because it's got like a spear on top too. It was like, at first I thought, it's like, oh, is that a trident? Because goddamn, that would be sick.
Right,
that'd be sick if he's just stabbing fools like the Aquaman or shit.
But
I thought it was a good, like, it's like something that sets him apart from all the other knights of Westeros, where they're all he's like got a fancy boarding axe, essentially he's going into action. I thought that was cool. The Valyrian's armor looks tip top, really amazing. I thought Damon looked good killing men. Like, by my count, he killed somewhere between 16 and 20, not counting the dragons and other stuff. He did, it's not like this. This was like, he was invincible. He ended up taking several arrows that slowed him down. I do wish we'd gotten. I wish we'd gotten a crab feeder duel. I wish they'd done one last wave of dudes and spent 30. But on the other hand, like, when I was watching this, I had on a background while I was compiling my notes and stuff, and I start looking at this crap. This guy doesn't seem like a guy who could stand up against Damon.
Yeah.
He's kind of like gimped up because of the late stage stone dragon scale he's got, which we know robs people of their sanity and their mobility. Like, I felt it would have probably been Damon just bullying the shit out of this guy.
Yeah, I would think so. It seems like there was a vicious fight, though, because he comes out drenched head to toe in blood, and he's no worse for wear. So it must be the crab feeder's blood. Now, that makes me worry, because grayscale is a pretty infectious disease. He's touching the crab feeder skin to skin, I think. Maybe he has gloves on.
This is all mildly interesting, especially since, I find it hard to believe they're going to have Daemon struggle with Grayscale, but I mean, I don't know. Maybe that, but if not, it does seem like it's an unforced logistical error, because you didn't have to make the guy suffer from this highly contagious, incurable disease and then have the guy bathe in his blood.
You know?
Like, the fact that there's people in my email, on Twitter, and on Reddit, oh my God, does anyone else think Daemon's got, you know, Grayscale? Or like, oh, aren't the Targaryens immune from disease? And, oh, no, if you look here, this Targaryen princess died of dragons. It's kind of a mess, and it didn't. Like Allison says, it needs not be this way, Condal.
Right.
It needs not be this way.
Yeah.
So, but, you know, I know we probably got a lot of fans pissed that we're like spending this much time giving the show. But like, honestly, we've lavished so much praise on this.
The fans are bothered by stuff.
Yeah, the fans. And you got to understand, the people that just like have no problem. Like, there's people that did have serious logistical problems, and we'd look like clowns if we didn't talk about it. You know, that's how you lose people's respect. Like,
I'm going to bring it up when I have problems with the show. We spent an hour 20 talking about how great the rest of this episode was. I don't feel like 10 minutes spent talking about some of its failures is not worthwhile or is too much.
I'm just dealing with the credit, like the pre, I'm trying to deal with the pre-criticism so I don't on Thursday.
Gotcha. All right. That's the end of the episode, unless you have anything else to say about that scene.
I don't think so. Like, people wanted that's the number one question in the instant take is, who is the dragon rider? Who is this dragon? Well, the dragon rider is Laenor.
Yeah.
The one that they're talking about marrying off to Rhaenyra. I'm a little surprised that you are resistant to this match, because like, we don't know what Rhaenyra will think, but there's a lot of like, this guy seems like he's the kind of dashing dragon riding, dude that might turn the head of Rhaenyra. That's like,
oh, she come off as resistant. I felt like Lord Strong was giving good advice.
No good advice from, but like from what you, I thought you were skeptical that Rhaenyra would be interested in him.
I don't know. There's something about this woohoo. Like, Rhaenyra is an experienced dragon rider. This guy seems like this is his first time on a dragon.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I don't think it's his first time, because they mentioned that they have dragons in the strategy session. So it's the first time we're seeing it.
It's probably his first time in an actual battle.
Oh, yeah. I think this guy is supposed to be a year or two younger than Rhaenyra and also like more novice of a dragon rider, because it's also Sea Smoke is, I think, hatched with him.
Oh, okay.
Or if not, was one of the youngest dragons that he claimed when he was a boy. So this is his dragon Sea Smoke, which, I could tell you a lot more about all these dragons, but it'd be a big spoiler. But he's this pale silver gray dragon that at the time of Fire and Blood is described as fighting size, but still young. So there, it's going to be like your classic fighting game. He's going to be trading raw power for speed and mobility. Mm. And I think they were trying to get at that with the whole yippee, try spinning, that's a good trick of the whole dragon riding experience. That, like, yeah.
Why don't you wear a helmet when you're riding a dragon? That's what I want to know.
I wonder if they'll go into some of the interesting lore of dragon riding, because there's like all kind of interesting things about how they saddle them up and how they secure the riders to the saddles. And I wonder if they'll go into the finer points of dragon riding.
Yeah, but, I don't know. I'm not necessarily opposed to Laenor. I need to know more about him, because currently, I don't know much other than he's,
I don't like his Ronald McDonald hair. I don't like his silver Ronald McDonald hair.
Okay.
Although that does solidify his relationship with Lord McCheese.
Yeah.
And the important Sesame Kingdom. You know, you gotta have them and their fry guys, their swore bannermen, if you want to have any kind of standing in Westeros. Yeah, I don't know. I like the Valyrians, but Laenor, I don't know. He's a little came across a little goofy to me this episode.
Gotcha.
But yeah, I think that's it. We're ready to stop talking about this. We're ready to start hearing what you guys have to say. HotD@baldmove.com is how you send stuff to us for consideration for a feedback episode. It's going to be come out in a couple days. Also be recording a segment with Maester Anthony, where I think I'm going to talk more about the White Hart and Arthurian legends. We'll see what the other side of that combo comes up with. But we're going to be considering all kinds of feedback. HotD@baldmove.com. Of course, you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/baldmove. If you want to check out all of our releases, if you want to make sure you get everything that has to do with wizards and dragons and spaceships and zombies and ninjas, all that kind of stuff, make sure you subscribe to Bald Move Pulp, because that's where we publish all of our
you know, pulpy podcast. Right now, we're also doing the Rings of Power. High degree of certainty that you will like the crossover. Those first two episodes are pretty good. If you got Amazon Prime Video, I recommend checking it out. It's a pretty good time, especially if you're a fan of the Tolkien stuff that's already out. That'll do it for this episode. Thanks for listening once again, and we'll see you in a couple days for feedback. Until then, I'm your host, Aaron.
And I'm Jim.